Amen. All right, we're in 1 Kings chapter 2. We are looking at the kings of Israel and Judah, and we started with Solomon because a fair amount's been done on David in the not-too-distant past. But we're in 1 Kings chapter number 2. We looked, last week we ended in chapter 2 looking at some of Solomon's early decisions. We talked about how David on his deathbed gave some instructions to Solomon. Here's some situations for you to deal with. And the first one that he had to deal with was Adonijah. That's in chapter 2, verses 13 through 25. That's where we left off last time. And just by a very brief review, Adonijah was related to Solomon how? Now, everybody at once. Okay, it was his brother, and specifically what relation? His older brother, and best we can tell, he was probably the oldest living brother at this point. Okay, so Adonijah went to Solomon's mother and said, hey, I want you to ask Solomon a request for me. Ask if I can have a particular maid. Now, who was the maid that he asked for? Abishag the Shunammite, right? Which was the one who ministered to David at the end of his life. So that she was considered part of the king's harem, therefore it was the king's property. So when he asked for the king's property, it was in essence saying the king's property belongs to me. Which is why when Solomon heard this, he reacted as strongly as he did. Because he recognized that this was an assault on his legitimacy as king. This sounds a lot like the election was rigged. I really should be the president, but we've heard a lot of that the last two election cycles, right? On both sides. But in fact, in his statement to Solomon's mother, he actually says, verse number 15. Thou knowest that the kingdom was mine, and all Israel set their faces on me that I should reign. Howbeit, the kingdom is turned about and has become my brother's, for it was his from the Lord. You notice he didn't say, well, God wanted my brother to be king, and I accept that. What he said was, it was mine, and now it's his. He has not let go of that yet. So then when he asked for Abishag, it was in essence an act of treason. So Solomon ordered his execution. He had already told him, you behave yourself, I'll let you live. You misbehave, you're a dead man. And so verse 25, Solomon sent Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, and he executed him. All right, now that brings us to verse 26, to Abiathar. Verse 26, Abiathar the priest said unto Abiathar the priest, said the king, get thee to Anathoth, unto thine own fields, for thou art worthy of death. Why was Abiathar worthy of death? All right, in the previous chapter, he had sided with Adonijah in the rebellion. Okay, now he had originally helped David when Absalom rebelled, but now he in the most recent issue with Adonijah, he had sided with the rebellion. So in essence, Solomon's saying, you've committed treason, you took the wrong side of this thing, you're worthy of death. But notice the rest of verse 26. But I will not at this time put thee to death, because thou bearest the ark of the Lord before David my father, and because thou hast been afflicted in all wherein my father was afflicted. So Abiathar did, at peril of his own life, get messages to David. He was with David partly, through a lot of difficult situations. So David here with Abiathar Solomon showed a little bit of mercy, but nonetheless, he threw him out of the priesthood. He said, look, you go to your house, you go to your farm, but you're not going to be a priest, you're not going to serve here, you're not going to have a position, you're not going to have any of the influence here. Notice verse 27. Solomon thrust out Abiathar from being priest unto the Lord, that he might fulfill the word of the Lord which he spake concerning the house of whom? Eli. God is patient when we aren't, right? I mean, if somebody has done me wrong, I want it dealt with yesterday, right? If God has promised something good to me, I want it now, right? We're, by nature, we're impatient. Okay, we're talking about the time of Solomon. This is the first year of Solomon's reign. How long was David king? 40 years. How long was Saul king prior to that? 40 years. And when did God tell this to Eli? I mean, that was the first thing that God said to Samuel when he called him, Samuel, Samuel, right? Now, God had sent another prophet previously to tell that to Eli in 1 Samuel chapter 2. But the first message God gives to Samuel is, I'm going to judge the house of Eli, when Samuel's a young man. Okay? And it was years before Saul was made king. So we're talking about, conservatively, we're talking about 100 years later. 40 years of David, 40 years of Saul, and you know, prior to that, when God had said this to Eli. I mean, we're talking about 100, 120 years later. Did God forget? No. In fact, in 1 Samuel chapter 15, we're most familiar with that, 1 Samuel 15 being Saul's disobedience, right? That's where Saul, 1 Samuel 15, to obey is better than sacrifice and hearken to the fat of rams. And Samuel told Saul, God would rather you just obey than to come up with your own thing. We're familiar with that. But what was the command that Saul disobeyed in 1 Samuel 15? Go kill the Amalekites. And in 1 Samuel 15, that whole story starts with God saying this, I remember what Amalek did. You know what? When Amalek did that? All the way back to Exodus chapter 17. Exodus 17, they're just barely out of Egypt. And, you know, they're just figuring things out in the wilderness, so to speak. And Amalek comes out and fights them. In fact, it's the same battle where Moses held up the rod. And when he held up the rod, Israel prevailed. And, you know, eventually Aaron and Hur held up his arms. It's that same battle they were fighting Amalek. Because Amalek were descendants of Esau. That's Israel's cousins. But they did not want to see anything good happen to Israel. They came out and fought against them. So from the time that that incident happened until the time God told Saul, go deal with Amalek, 300 years. Okay, here, from the time God finally fulfilled the last of that with the house of Eli, over 100 years. So what does that mean? What's the practical application for you and me? I've been praying about this for a year and nothing's happened. And? I've been praying about this for 10 years and nothing's happened. And? You see what I'm saying? Now, I don't naturally think that way. I have to be reminded. I'm reminding myself right now. Because we want it now. We expect to see it now. But there, did God keep his promise? Yeah. In some cases, 10 years down the road. Some cases, immediately. Some cases, 100 years down the road. But here, when it says in verse number 27 that the word of the Lord might be fulfilled concerning the house of Eli and Shiloh, God is keeping his word. He did not forget. But it was 100, 120 years later before the final fulfillment was realized. So, just because we haven't seen it work out the way we want it yet doesn't mean, well, I guess I've prayed long enough, it's not going to happen. It doesn't mean, well, God forgot this one. It just means God doesn't operate on our timetable. He doesn't operate on our schedule. And here, by this point in time in the story, if we're just reading through the Bible, we're all the way through 1 Samuel, we're all the way through 2 Samuel, we're into Kings, we've forgotten about Eli. That was a long time ago. But God hadn't forgotten about it. And when God makes a promise, he keeps it. And so when Solomon thrust Abiathar out of the priesthood, that was the final fulfillment of God's judgment on the house of Eli. All right, so now that brings us in verse number 28 to Joab. Remember, these are the scenarios that that David had told Solomon, you're going to have to deal with these. Verse 28, then tidings came to Joab. For Joab had turned after Adonijah, though he turned not after Absalom. Tidings of what? I mean, we're not specifically told, but I think a little common sense, we can figure out the most likely answer. Tidings of what? I think verse number 24 and 25. Solomon told Adonijah, all right, that's it, you're done. He put Adonijah to death. Okay, and Abiathar's thrust out. Okay, in this same context. So what are the tidings? I think the execution of Adonijah and possibly the, if I want to alliterate it, the excommunication of Abiathar. So now Joab's like, uh-oh, I'm next. Why? Well, it's explained here in verse 28. He had sided with Adonijah. He did not side with Absalom. In fact, Joab's the one that put a dart through Absalom when he was hanging in the tree caught by his hair. But at the end, Joab had sided with the wrong side against David's chosen king. So I think Joab figured he was next. It's interesting in the condemnation here, I think Joab knew it was coming too. So you know, he knew. Verse number 28, the tidings came to Joab, for Joab turned after Adonijah, though he'd not turned after Absalom. And Joab fled to the tabernacle of the Lord and caught hold on the horns of the altar. All right, I think that is, you know, a little bit symbolic. You see that expression at different times, but the horns of the altar were protrusions on each corner. And so he's hanging, physically holding on to the altar. What is the altar? It's a place of sacrifice. It's a place of atonement. It's a place where forgiveness was realized, right? So in essence, that is also where, you know, if you're offering a sacrifice to God to entreat him, that's where it was offered. In fact, the very horns of the altar were, the blood of the sacrifices was put on the horns of the altar. And so that the horns of the altar, that's a place of atonement, it's a place of forgiveness, it's a place of intercession or laying out requests. All of those things, you know, are involved in that. So in essence, he's gone to what in his view would be the Supreme Court, you know, the final place of appeal. He caught hold on the horns of the altar. Now, the horns of the altar, that's the place of sacrifice. This was likely in the courtyard where the tabernacle was set up at this point. Was he supposed to be there? Who was supposed to be in the courtyard of the tabernacle and offering sacrifices? The priests and Levites. Okay, so he knew that. So in essence, he felt like this was a serious enough situation that he better breach protocol. Okay, so he goes there, verse 29. It was told King Solomon that Joab was fled to the tabernacle of the Lord, and behold, he is by the altar. Then Solomon sent Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, saying, go fall upon him. Verse 30, Benaiah came to the tabernacle of the Lord and said unto him, thus saith the king, come forth. And he said, nay, but I will die here. I'm not coming out. You're going to kill me. You have to kill me right here. You know, maybe he thought that hanging out there would, you know, the reluctance to shed blood at the altar or in the courtyard of the Lord's house might be a temporary reprieve for him. The middle of verse 30, Benaiah brought the king word again, saying, thus saith Joab, and thus he answered me. Verse 31, the king said unto him, do as he hath said, and fall upon him and bury him, that thou mayest take away the innocent blood which Joab shed from me and from the house of my father. And the Lord shall return his blood upon his own head, who fell upon two men more righteous and better than he, and slew them with the sword, my father David, not knowing thereof. That's very important. Okay, David did not endorse it. In fact, when these two men are named, Abner the son of Ner, captain of the host of Israel, when that happened, all right, David was just king over Hebron in the south. Abner finally got tired of Ishbosheth, and he came to David and he said, look, I can broker a peace treaty. I can unite the kingdom and we'll all get behind you as king. And David said, great, let's do it. And I'm going to make you captain of my army instead of Joab. And then, you know, Joab assassinated him. He said, well, you can't trust him. But the Bible also tells us it was a personal vendetta because Joab's brother had been killed in battle by Abner. All right. But when that happened, when Joab assassinated Abner, what did David do? This is early in 2 Samuel. David, you know, wore sackcloth and mourned and sent out a proclamation. I believe it's in 2 Samuel chapter 3. But David made it very clear, I had nothing to do with this, and I don't endorse this, I don't approve of this. He did not execute Joab at that point. I mean, the only explanation I've already given you to me is David had made some sort of agreement with Joab. But that was the first instance, Abner, the son of Ner. And then again in verse 32, and end of the verse, and Amasa, the son of Jether, captain of the host of Judah. That was after the rebellion of Absalom. Okay, so Absalom's rebelled, and Joab killed Abner. And, you know, sometime after that point, he had been demoted again. Well, David put Amasa in charge, and Joab ended up catching up with him and assassinating him too. All right? So that's the two stories there. Verse 33, their blood shall therefore return on the head of Joab and upon the head of his seed forever. But upon David and upon his seed and upon his house and upon his throne shall there be peace forever from the Lord. So in essence, Solomon is saying, my father David's not guilty of this. Let that judgment fall on his house. Do you remember in the end of 2 Samuel 21:22, do you remember there was a famine from the Lord 3 years while David was king? David goes to the Lord and says, why is this famine? What was the answer from God? Because of Saul's bloody house. And it goes back to when Saul had killed the Gibeonites, that way back in the book of Joshua, they made a treaty they weren't supposed to make. But Saul had killed some of them. And God said, I'm judging you because, in essence, Saul shed blood wrongly. Solomon didn't want that to happen to him. He didn't want to be judged for what Joab had done. So he said, look, let his house bear the responsibility for that. Verse 34, so Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, went up and fell upon him and slew him. And he was buried in his own house in the wilderness. Now, this fell upon him is the idea of to attack, okay, to fall upon suddenly. My literal mind wants to picture, you know, how did he fall on him? But that's not the case. But it's interesting. He sent Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, right in there to the altar to deal with him. You say, well, is Benaiah going to be in trouble? No, best I can tell, by running, you know how there's sections in Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles that you're like, oh no. So-and-so begat so-and-so begat so-and-so. So-and-so, the son of the son of the son of the son of. And you're like, oh. That's in your reading section. Sometimes those sections are really useful. This is one of those sections. Best I can tell, comparing these listings in Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles, Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was not only one of David's mighty men, and Solomon's, he would become the captain of the guard for Solomon. He was also a Levite. Okay? So he was, and I think he might have even been one of the singers. Okay? But he was definitely in the family of the priests and Levites. So was Benaiah outside of his appropriate realm to go into the courtyard of the tabernacle? No. You know, in fact, he could legitimately go in there, and he went in there, and he executed Joab, and then they took him out and buried him. So Solomon is going down his punch list that David left him. He's dealt with Adonijah. He's dealt with Abiathar. He's dealt with Joab. Verse 35, the king put Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, in his room over the host. In other words, he was the captain of the army, the captain of the guard. And Zadok, the priest, did the king put in the room of Abiathar. All right, so now that brings us to the final task that David had left Solomon in the deathbed instructions. Verse 36, we have the story of Shimei. And the king sent and called for Shimei, and he said unto him, build thee a house in Jerusalem and dwell there, and go not forth thence any whither. For it shall be that on the day thou goest out and passest over the brook Kidron, thou shalt know for certain, thou shalt surely die, for thy blood shall be upon thy own head. Is that an ambiguous scenario here for Shimei? Or is that pretty clear? Yeah, it's not ambiguous at all. Okay, he said, now, where did Shimei live? Somewhere else. Okay, Shimei was of the house of whom? Anybody remember? Saul. Shimei is the one that cursed David. When David decided to leave instead of fight Absalom, Shimei came out and cursed him and threw stones at him and said, you know, it's because you mistreated the house of Saul. He was of the tribe of Benjamin. Okay? I love what Joab Abishai, you know, some of the men that were right around David. I love what they said in that story. I believe that's 2 Samuel chapter 16. But I love what they said. You know, when he's casting stones at David, one of those men said to David, just once. Just let me smite him once. I won't have to hit him a second time. I love it. And he's like, we don't have to put up with this. And we don't have to put up with this, David. Just give me one shot. That's all I need. I don't need six in the revolver. I just need one. Okay? And David said, no, we're not going to do that. Well, then when David comes back after Absalom is killed in battle, Shimei kind of comes back with his hat in his hand and said, you know, basically, please forgive me. I was a moron. That's not quite in the Hebrew. That's my paraphrase of that. But he said, I shouldn't have done it. And David said, all right, I'm not going to put you to death. David's trying to bring healing. And he thought another execution at this point might not help to calm the tensions. And so he said, all right, I'm not going to do it. But he told Solomon, I didn't promise him you wouldn't do it. You take care of him. So this is a test. Shimei was of the house of Saul, of the tribe of, or at least of the tribe of Benjamin. So he had an inheritance somewhere else. So even though Solomon told him, build your house here at Jerusalem and stay here, it was in essence, if I could say it this way, it was a life sentence of house arrest. It's the most common way I could find to illustrate it in our society today. He wasn't allowed to go home. Guess for Thanksgiving, he didn't go to grandma's house or Passover or New Moon or, you know, the times when they would get, he didn't go to mama's house. He didn't go anywhere. He couldn't go back to his farm. I mean, he was on house arrest in Jerusalem. The story goes here, verse 38, Shimei agreed to it. Verse 39, it came to pass at the end of 3 years, two of the servants of Shimei ran away to Achish, son of Maacah, king of Gath. And they told Shimei, saying, behold, thy servants be in Gath. And Shimei rose and saddled his ass and went to Gath to Achish to seek his servants. Now, this sounds like a normal thing, right? Servants ran away, master goes back to get them. That's kind of expected. But what were the terms of Shimei's house arrest? You stay here. If you cross this boundary line, you're a dead man. Did he forget? Was his anger such that he just went anyway? Possible. Is it possible that he thought after 3 years he could just kind of fly under the radar and get away with it? I don't have a definitive answer, but I'm just saying that human nature is the same today as it was then. And that's what people today would be doing. But nonetheless, what happened? Verse 41, it was told Solomon Shimei had gone from Jerusalem to Gath. Verse 42, the king sent and called for Shimei. Did I not make thee swear by the Lord? And he repeats the terms here. And he said, did I not make thee swear by the Lord? And protested unto thee, saying, no, for a certain, on the day thou goest out and walkest abroad any whither, thou shalt surely die. And thou saidst unto me, the word that I've heard is good. Why then hast thou not kept the oath of the Lord and the commandment I've charged thee? The king said moreover to Shimei, thou knowest all the wickedness which thine heart is privy to, that thou didst to David my father. Therefore the Lord shall return thy wickedness on thine own head. And King Solomon shall be blessed, and the throne of David shall be established before the Lord forever. So the king commanded Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, which went out and fell upon him, and he died. And the kingdom was established in the hand of Solomon. Now, that sounds like Solomon's already exercising some wisdom, doesn't it? He didn't just go out, you know, the first week after his inauguration and execute all of David's political enemies, right? Now, he did do that with, he gave Adonijah conditions, and Adonijah violated him. He was executed. He got rid of Abiathar the priest. He dealt with Joab, as David had said, but he gave Shimei conditions. So how long has it been at this point? We were told here, how long did Shimei live there before he went running after his runaway servants? 3 years. Okay, so we're a little ways into Solomon's reign at this point. All right, so now we're talking about some good things that he's done. Here's a not so good thing that he did in chapter 3, verse 1. Solomon made affinity with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and took Pharaoh's daughter and brought her into the city of David until he had made an end of building his own house and the house of the Lord and the wall of Jerusalem round about. So he married Pharaoh's daughter. You're like, well, whatever. You know, he took a bride. Kings do that. For Israel, what was the command about who they were to marry? They were to marry within their nation. And the priests were to marry within their own tribe. And God said, this is primarily for your religious protection. Okay? Israel was in bondage for 400 years where? In Egypt. I mean, who chased them with chariots through the wilderness to the Red Sea? Egypt. I mean, It seems like from a distant perspective, man, why in the world would you ever make friends with Egypt? How long has it been from the time Pharaoh chased him with chariots till now? Over 450 years. I mean, 450 years. And eventually, you know, Solomon had a little different perspective on this thing. I mean, that should have been a little bit of a warning, especially, you know, with Egypt. It might have made some more sense with some others, but Egypt was close enough, they're always going to be back and forth. And as we see, Solomon was a businessman, and Egypt was a major trade partner. They're right on the Mediterranean, you got the Nile River, you got the land trade routes. Egypt was prosperous. But I just say this to say, this is also an early decision of Solomon that wasn't all that good. Eventually, after the next section where he asks God for understanding heart and he builds the temple and he has the dedication and he builds his own house and all that, then what we roll over into is Solomon's downfall. And one of the things that specifically mentioned in Solomon's downfall was what he built for Pharaoh's daughter and then what he built for other wives. I believe that's long about chapter 10 or 11. What did he build for those other wives? He built temples for their gods. And he built them houses in other places because they didn't want to live in the capital city where, you know, the worship of Israel's God was the main thing. So he put them in other places and tolerated their gods. I mean, usually we think about Solomon and think, well, the wisest man that ever lived. He was the son of David. He was the richest man in history. And we think about all of those things. But understand, Solomon is to blame for the idolatry of Israel. Solomon tolerated it, even though he built the house of God and he took care of the Levites and all that. Solomon laid the foundation for Israel's downfall. Even though it didn't happen in his lifetime, later on, and I'm fast forwarding a little bit because it's connected to this decision right here. But fast forward a little bit, God appears to Solomon in a dream. Now, the first time's in chapter 3. We're going to start that today. In chapter 3, he appears to Solomon in a dream and says, ask anything you want. And he says, I need an understanding heart. All right, well, later on, God appears to Solomon in a dream again. And he said, you've done exactly what I told you not to do. You brought in all these strange wives and you made houses for their gods and you've defiled my land. He said, Solomon, I would judge you, but for the sake of David, I'm going to judge your son. Did God approve of Solomon? No. And we often, in running the historical timeline, go, well, as soon as Solomon was dead, Rehoboam made a dumb decision, and he did, and then the kingdom split. While all of that's true, Solomon is the one who laid the foundation for Israel's downfall. Solomon's decisions, even though the fruit did not mature in his lifetime, the seed was planted. The seed was planted, it was watered, and the plant sprouted. It's just that the fruit didn't mature until after Solomon's death. Okay? Reminds of another king that said, as long as there's peace in my days, right? Not the right attitude. But this decision here in Solomon's early years, this would have been a political marriage. Often the sign of a peace treaty between two nations was that the offspring of the two kings would be married off to each other. The thought is, if your child and hopefully your grandchildren live here, then you're not going to attack us and put your kids and grandkids at risk. That was kind of some of the reasoning behind that being a part of a peace treaty between nations. But in chapter 3, verse 1, Solomon married the daughter of Pharaoh, and later on we're going to see that she had an influence on him towards idolatry. So some of these other decisions were good decisions. Building the house of the Lord was a good thing. But not every decision that Solomon made was wise. All right, now let's roll over into chapter 3 and talk about Solomon's request for wisdom. This was very interesting to me because we often talk about it as Solomon's request for wisdom. But in this chapter, who used the term wisdom or wise? God used the term wise. Solomon didn't actually use that specific word. Let's look at it. Verse 5, in Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night. Now I skipped verse 4. The king went to Gibeon to sacrifice there. There was a great high place. 1,000 burnt offerings did Solomon offer upon that altar. Now I don't care if it was 1,000 pigeons. That's a lot of offerings. And they weren't all birds, which was the sacrifice of a poor person. 1,000 burnt offerings. That's a pretty significant offering to the Lord, right? Then in Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night, verse 5. And God said, ask what I shall give thee. And Solomon said, thou hast showed unto thy servant David my father great mercy, according as he walked before thee in truth, and in righteousness, and in uprightness of heart with thee. And thou hast kept for him this great kindness, that thou hast given him a son to sit on his throne, as it is this day. And now, O Lord my God, thou hast made thy servant king instead of David my father. And I am but a little child, and I know not how to go out or to come in. Now let's stop right there for a minute. He said, I am but a little child. When we hear that phrase, what, how do we think of that being used in 2022? We think of that as maybe, you know, the toddlers, maybe the kindergarten age, maybe primaries, right? This word, is this same word that's used here is used in many places. It's used of a wide age range. This same word for young man or youth is used in Exodus chapter 2 when Pharaoh's daughter found a little ark floating in the river and she opened it up and there was a child in there. This same word is translated babe in that passage. Okay? A little bit later in 1 Samuel chapter 4, let me back up. In 1 Samuel chapter 1, Samuel is described with this same word, the same Old Testament word, and his mother said, no, he's not weaned yet, but he could have easily been 2 or 3 years old. Often the full weaning process wasn't until they were 4 or 5 years old. I'm not going back to the tabernacle until he's fully weaned, and when I take him there, I'm going to leave him there. So this word is used of an infant. It's used of a young boy. This term is used in 2 Kings chapter 5 when Naaman had leprosy and the prophet told him to go dip 7 times in the river, and the Bible says his flesh was restored as that of a little child. Same term. Okay. Now, it's also used in other contexts. In Genesis 21, it's used of Ishmael when Ishmael was mocking and Sarah said, cast out the bondwoman and her son. And it said, the Bible says that Abraham was grieved because of the lad or the young man. It's the same term, okay? Comparing Genesis 21 with Genesis 16, we see that Ishmael is about 13, 14 years old at that time. This same term is used in Genesis 37 of Joseph. In Genesis 37, we're specifically told that the young lad, Joseph, was 17 years old when his dad sent him to check on his brothers. They eventually sold him as a slave and lied to dad by dipping his coat in blood. What I'm saying is this is used of Moses as an infant. It's used of Samuel as a young child. It's used of Ishmael as a teenager. It's used of Joseph as a teenager. It's used in 1 Samuel 16 when Samuel looked at Jesse and said, are these all your sons? That term sons is the same word. Okay, so we think of this term as, you know, young child or a little child as maybe 0 to 10 kind of thing. But this term was used in several contexts. In fact, in 1 Kings chapter 20, this same term, was the young men who were the servants of the princes may well refer to young soldiers. Okay, so this does not mean that Solomon was 10 years old when he became king. There are other instances in the Old Testament where a very young child like that was promoted, but that was Solomon's view of himself. I feel like a young child under this responsibility. You don't have to be, you know, under 20 to feel that way. You can be given new responsibilities, and you're like, man, I thought I was ready for this, and I feel like a child. I have no idea how to handle this situation. That's what Solomon's saying here. He says, I'm but a little child. I know not how to go out or to come in. Those are descriptive terms that are used in the Old Testament of how one's life is conducted, to go out to do your business. In other words, know when it's time to work and know when it's time to leave it alone, come home. Okay? Verse 8, thy servant is in the midst of thy people, which thou hast chosen to be a great people that cannot be numbered nor counted for multitude. Verse 9, give therefore thy servant an understanding heart to judge thy people, that I may discern between good and bad. For who is able to judge this thy so great a people? What was Solomon's specific request? An understanding heart. Now, I am a word study kind of person. You know, you probably have figured that out already. But it's very interesting to me, the words that are used here back and forth. This word understanding is the same word. The basic meaning of this word means to hear. Okay, to hear or to listen. So in essence, what he's saying is, give me a heart that listens well. Okay, you understand the difference between hearing and listening? You can hear what's being said without actually listening and understanding what's being said. Okay? Yes, you understand that with your kids. You understand that with your spouse. You understand that with your job. You understand it in lots of different contexts, right? But here he said, give thy servant an understanding heart. In other words, to be one that's an effective listener. So the basic meaning of the word is to listen, and then by definition, to hear, and by definition, it's to have understanding or to listen and understand what's being said. An understanding heart to judge thy people. That term judge is used a couple of times. It's the word that means the judge, the one who's responsible to make a decision. Okay? And then the next phrase, that I may discern between good and bad. Now that word discernment has the idea of understanding or insight. It's more what we would think of as discernment. You ever played the game where they put different objects in maybe a bowl of rice, and you have to reach in there and find what you were told to get? Okay? And there, maybe it's jelly beans, maybe it's Lifesavers, maybe it's something else. But you put something in rice, and all those little grains of dry rice will confuse your nerves, confuse your senses. And in your mind, you have to divide out, you have to discern, okay, what texture is what. Well, that's the idea of discernment, to be able to understand, to make a division between things, so to speak. So he said, I need an understanding heart. I need discernment to be able to sort out what is truth and what is chaff. And then, you know, these same words, the word that means to hear for understanding heart, in verse number 11 at the end, God says, thou hast asked for thyself understanding to discern judgment. The words are flipped. The word understanding in verse 11 is the word for discernment. And then the word discern judgment is the word to hear. What I'm saying is these words are used a little bit interchangeably. I mean, sometimes we like to go to places like this or go to Proverbs and do a really in-depth word study. This word means this and this word means this. And many times they were kind of used interchangeably as synonyms. But this word understanding is interchangeable with wisdom. But it was actually in verse 11 that God used the term wisdom. I'm out of time. I'll have to pick up there next week. I'm sorry I had to wrap this up at an inopportune place, but it'll give you a chance to think about it a little bit, hopefully. And maybe you can do a little bit of your own study on that. But Solomon asked for wisdom. Why? I think at least partially it was because he had to deal with Abiathar, Joab, and Shimei. He's like, man, I need help. I need some understanding in what to do. But this request pleased the Lord, and we'll pick up from there and go on next week.